From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Presidents have been dealing with disasters since our country's earliest days. During a recent visit to Raleigh, a noted presidential historian highlighted the presidents who've done the best job and those who've done the worst job handling emergencies. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has had little good to say about Republican tax policies. His criticism prompted a response recently from one of the state house's top tax writers. The Chief Justice of North Carolina's Supreme Court is one of the top backers of an initiative called Raise the Age. It deals with juvenile criminal offenders. You'll learn why he supports it. Plus, we'll feature a critique of High Point's proposal to spend millions of taxpayer dollars for a downtown baseball stadium. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The United States Supreme Court has now spoken. In a 5-3 ruling, the High Court has affirmed a lower court ruling that said the congressional district maps North Carolina used for the 2012 and 2014 elections are discriminatory and cannot stand. Rick Henderson is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He is here with us to explain this latest ruling. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, are any election results impacted by this at all?
Nothing that's taken place before now has been affected at all.
Okay. And it is a 5-3 ruling. And if you've studied the Supreme Court, you know that there are 9 seats.
Correct. The newest justice, Neil Gorsuch, did not take place in either the arguments or the deliberations for this case. So only 8 justices were involved.
What does the ruling say?
The ruling basically says, of interest, it's 8-0. It was a unanimous court ruling that the first congressional district appears to have had some racial gerrymandering involved.
That's northeastern North Carolina.
Correct. That's basically a district that stretches from the far northeastern corner of the state and reaches into Durham County now. So it's a huge district. The 5-3 part affected the 12th congressional district, or the infamous I-85 district that roughly stretches from Charlotte to Greensboro, and said that race was a factor, the predominant factor in deciding the composition of that district.
Now, Rick, as I recall, when the Republicans were drawing districts, and they have the power now to draw districts because they were elected to majorities. So in 2010, when the new census came out, that's why they have been drawing these districts. I recall them at least saying that they were paying particular attention to going by previous rulings and making sure that everything was in line and would pass legal muster. So what happened?
Well, they got preclearance from the Justice Department for these, but subsequently the Supreme Court has ruled that that preclearance may not be sufficient, that there are issues about what aspects of the Voting Rights Act apply to cases that are brought on racial grounds. And so that – apparently the preclearance didn't really matter as much to the justices in this case. And also there was a situation in which the court had ruled that the maps were unconstitutional and that the General Assembly had to come and draw new maps. And so they were drawing maps that were based – they said on partisan gerrymandering issues, but not on racial issues. In other words, they were trying to maintain a 10-3 Republican majority in the state's congressional delegation, which is what had existed before the maps were challenged, after an election had taken place and before the maps were challenged.
Rick, is it legal then to draw a district to your political advantage if you are the party in power versus drawing it with some sort of racial intent?
Probably. That's one of the issues that we're dealing with right now and that the court's dealing with, is that Justice Anthony Kennedy has made it extremely unclear to what extent partisanship can play a role. Justice Stephen Breyer, I think, has had this a similar opinion to this, and that previously the idea with the courts was, as long as you preserve the concept of one person, one vote, you cannot use race as the main factor in drawing congressional districts, but you can use partisan affiliation of the voters. And so the courts have said, you can be as partisan as you like as long as race isn't an issue in the states affected by the Voting Rights Act, or those portions of the states affected by the Voting Rights Act. And starting in 2015, we started to see a little bit of a break in that long-standing precedent about partisan gerrymandering, and the court has really not yet been clear to what extent partisanship can play a role in the way that districts are drawn.
Here's where it gets really fascinating, I think. Because African Americans are voting 90% plus for the Democratic Party candidate, how do you distinguish between someone who's drawing a district for political reasons and something that has a racial component to it?
Well, that is an argument that has to deal with the situation that currently exists, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says that African Americans have to vote Democratic, or that white Americans have to vote Republican. I mean, that's a decision that's made by individuals. And so that's the sort of thing that makes these types of cases very, very difficult. Because if the court says partisanship rules, then the racial balance of the party shouldn't really matter. If the courts say partisanship really doesn't count that much and it's all about race, and that makes these calculations a lot more different than they used to be.
Let's talk about a couple of the justices and how they weighed in on this decision. First of all, you had what was a surprise to some folks that Justice Clarence Thomas was in with the majority, mm-hmm. ruling against North Carolina. You had Justice Sam Alito writing a vigorous dissent. Let's talk first about Justice Thomas.
Justice Thomas does not believe race should play a role in any of these deliberations whatsoever, and so he sided with the majority because he said race was used as a factor, and because race was used as a factor, then I'm going to toss out the districts. That was really his consideration. Didn't matter whether it was favoring one race over another or disfavoring one race over another. He said it doesn't matter. Or that he didn't say that in his concurrence, but that has been his attitude about these all along, that race should not be considered an issue. And so he just said, I agree with the majority. Race was an issue, so therefore they're gone.
Justice Alito was one of the three who dissented, and quite vigorously.
Yes, he basically, if read from his text, he basically said that a precedent of this court should not be treated like a disposable household item, say a paper plate or napkin, to be used once and then tossed in the trash. And the earlier precedents had required a party challenging a gerrymandering process or a redistricting process to come up with an alternative map, to say, if you drew the map this way, it would satisfy the Constitution. The way it's currently drawn does not satisfy the Constitution. Well, the people bringing the lawsuit here didn't do that, and they weren't ever asked to or expected to do that. And so Justice Alito and Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy all said, look, you didn't come up with an alternative map. We don't know whether to judge if your map was better than the map that was presented to us. And so, therefore, we're attempting to make a ruling on something that that doesn't exist. And so their argument was, in part, that the alternative map requirement is something that needs to be part of this process. But they also said that there was not really any coherent evidence that race was the predominant factor in the drawing of the 12th congressional district. They said it was politics. It was basically to guarantee that there was a Democrat elected in this district rather than a Republican. So they said the alternative map requirement was the real, was the actual reason for not going along with the majority. But even without an alternative map, there was no compelling evidence, they said, that race was the predominant factor in the drawing of this district.
The maps we're talking about were used for 2012 and 2014. What about 2016?
General Assembly drew another set of maps, and what they did this time was they simply said, okay, we're going to only look at partisan affiliation. We're going to be as close as possible as we can to make sure that every district has exactly the same number of voters as every other district, and that's how we're going to deal with it. And we just want to make sure that there's a 10-3 Republican advantage as much as possible in the congressional delegation, and that's what happened. But those districts are going to be now the source of another set of legal proceedings. So, yeah, it never ends.
And advocates for redistricting reform, taking it out of the hands of the party in power, have often pointed to these continual legal cases as one of the reasons they say that it shouldn't be done this way. But we'll leave that for another segment. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal and CarolinaJournal.com. You can follow him on Twitter at
Deregulator.
Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. All presidents face emergencies, many of them unexpected. Our next guest has studied 2 centuries of disaster management from the Oval Office. That's the subtitle of the book titled, Shall We Wake the President? Its author is Tevi Troy, who joins us now. Thanks for joining us in the program.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. Really excited to be here and talk about disasters and presidents.
So what made you think that this was something worthy of a book, looking at how these presidents over the years have dealt with emergency management and disasters?
Well, Mitch, I worked in the Bush administration, and it seemed to me that the entire administration was shaped by disasters, including 9/11 right at the outset in President Bush's first year, obviously Katrina in the first year of his second term, and then the financial crisis towards the end of his administration. And I noticed the extent to which disasters shaped how presidents approach things, shaped how the White House staff and the entire government approach things, and also helped determine the legacy of presidents. At the same time, these are really important for the American people in terms of knowing that they have someone who's in charge of things and wants to help them get through the disaster. So it occurred to me to look at this question of how other presidents have handled disasters and give the American people and future presidents some advice about how to go about it better in the future.
You had firsthand experience with the Bush administration working on this. As you looked into the history of it, what were some of the things that really leaped out at you as very interesting or surprising?
While working in the administration, I noticed one thing that was that it seemed as if almost every department got involved in disasters. Agencies that you thought wouldn't have anything to do with a disaster, HUD or labor, they were heavily involved. The second thing is, as I was saying earlier, that it takes the entire White House. It sucks all the energy and it becomes the focus of everything. And the third thing is that government is really not very good at it, that you have all this money and you spend it on FEMA. And yes, FEMA does come with some aid and supplies eventually. But in those first 24 to 48 hours, if there's a disaster in your area, you are pretty much on your own. It's yourself, your family, your community. And that's what you have to rely on in the initial stage after disaster. And that's why in the book, I have advice for individuals for how to prepare for disaster so that you're not just relying on government.
Let's get to some of that advice in just a bit. Going back to the history of this, were there any particular administrations that leaped out at you as doing an especially good job or such a terrible job that no one should ever emulate them?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the book, In Shall We Wake the President, I have a list of the 5 best and 5 worst presidents at dealing with disasters. And number one on my worst list is Woodrow Wilson and his handling of the 1918 flu. When I read about this, I was just shocked. 675,000 Americans died. The average life expectancy of Americans dropped by a decade as a result of this flu. And President Wilson not only did nothing, but he took certain steps that I think made it worse. For example, he was told that the troop transports that were taking American servicemen to Europe to fight in World War I were spreading the disease among American servicemen and among the people of Europe. And so he was warned about this, and he after a discussion in the White House, decided not to stop those troop transports. He also had a propaganda machine that was trying to highlight happy news and discourage talk of sad things. And so in that sense, they didn't have the dissemination of information about the crisis and what people could do about it.
And how about the best? Who did the best?
Well, I got to say, I give a lot of credit to Bill Clinton for prevention of Y2K. Now, we're not sure if Y2K, which was the thing that happened around the switch from 1999 to 2000, where there was some thought that computers couldn't handle that switch from one millennium to another. But it might have led to a meltdown of our computer systems. And Bill Clinton marshaled state, local, federal resources. He worked with the private sector. He worked with our international partners, and he made sure it didn't happen. So I think preventing a disaster is the best thing a president can do.
Yeah, in fact, those of us who lived through it probably are thinking back and going, oh, yeah, Y2K. There was big concern about it at the time and didn't end up being much of a problem at all. We're speaking with Tevi Troy, who is the author of the book, Shall We Wake the President? 2 Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office. As you went through the preparation for this book, did it send you back into the days of working in the Bush White House and saying, I wish we had thought of this, or I'm glad we didn't do this? Were there things that you that took you back to your White House experience and made you think, okay, well, we did this and another administration did this better or much worse than what we did?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I remember one striking moment along those lines when I was reading about the 1968 race riots in Washington after the tragic assassination of Martin Luther King. And I was looking at pictures, and I saw a picture of Lyndon B. Johnson, who was president at the time, and didn't do a very good job at preventing the riots, which pretty much took place every summer during his presidency. They called them the long, hot summers. And Johnson is in a helicopter flying over downtown Washington, D.C., and looking at the devastation below in Marine One, the president's helicopter. And he looked ineffectually below. And in that picture, he looked eerily like George W. Bush in his infamous flyover over the Katrina area. So a lesson I take from the book is that sometimes it's a good idea for a president to go to a disaster area. Sometimes it's a good idea for a president, because it takes up local resources, not to go to a disaster area. But it's never a good idea to do a flyover.
One of the things that you mentioned a little bit earlier is the fact that your book mentioned some advice for individuals so they don't have to rely on government in the times of disaster. What are some of the things you want people to know individually?
Well, first let me just say that I'm not some kind of prepper, and I don't have an underground bunker in my backyard or anything like that. But I do have some food and water in my house just in case. I think people should have some kind of home protection. I'm not going to weigh in on what exactly that should be. I mean, we do have a Second Amendment in this country, but some people want to have other forms of home protection. That's fine. You should have a plan with your family. If, let's say, communication goes out, where can you go and what can you do? Have some cash on hand. There are things you can do to prepare yourselves. There are certain non-perishable items that you can store for the long term. One person in Hollywood told me that he stores a lot of toilet paper in his basement because, A, it's something you'll need in a crisis, but, B, it's also something that you could barter if things go really wrong.
Very true, because everyone's going to need toilet paper. How about for the government? What are some things that you think governments, the Trump administration or other future administrations, could learn from this book that'll help with the next disaster?
I think the first and number one lesson is that governments/presidents need to think about this. They can't just go blindly and say, oh, yeah, I'll deal with the disaster when it comes. And one thing we did in the Bush administration was tabletop exercises. And those tabletop exercises really helped inform our thinking about how to approach disasters. And they also raised issues that we didn't think of beforehand. So I remember there was one tabletop exercise where we imagined 2 crises happening at once. And one thing that we didn't anticipate and we were unprepared for was the extent to which the hospitals were swamped, not with sick people, but with what's known as the worried well, people who think they have the disease even if they don't. So I think these kinds of exercises really help introduce the players in government to their colleagues so that they're ready for a disaster, and they also help them think through issues before they become disasters.
Our time remaining is short, but given your experience in the Bush White House, what we saw with 8 years of Barack Obama, now a Trump administration in place, do you have a sense of whether there are people within the federal government who see this issue and are trying to get this in front of the policymakers to make sure that they're paying attention to these things?
It's hard to say for sure because they haven't filled out all of the policy roles. I mean, the top level people aren't necessarily the ones who focus on this. But I do know a couple of things. Number one is that the HHS budget, the Health and Human Services budget, includes funding or a request for funding for better preparation for bioterror attacks.
The book is titled Shall We Wake the President? Two Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office. The author is Tevi Troy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at @JohnLockeNC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at @JohnLockeNC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has been speaking out against Republican legislators' tax policies. That doesn't sit well with people like John Zocca, one of the state house's chief tax writers.
Let's roll back the calendar to 2011, when House Republicans inherited a $2.5 billion deficit after decades of liberal tax and spend policy that was promoted by, among others, our now Governor Roy Cooper, when he was in the North Carolina General Assembly. So what's happened since then? Since then, House Republicans and Senate Republicans have made very tough decisions to put North Carolina's fiscal house back in order. And I will tell you that the results speak for themselves. What are the facts? The facts are that we have balanced the budget every year. Let that one sink in for a minute. We have balanced the budget every single year. We've enacted fiscally conservative ideas to create a surplus while cutting taxes and putting more money in the pockets of all hardworking North Carolinians. When we talk about more money in the pockets of North Carolinians, we're not talking about small amounts. We're talking about over $4 billion that taxpayers in this state have kept rather than paying to the state for bloated services. So the results of this policy has been exactly that. We've returned money to North Carolinians. The people who earn the money get to keep more of what they earn. And that is really contrary to the empty rhetoric from liberal special interest groups and failed predictions from liberal think tanks. They predicted that by lowering taxes, by reducing regulations, that we would fail and drive this state down into the dirt somehow. But the exact opposite has happened. North Carolinians now have more money in their pockets thanks to the tax reforms the Republicans have enacted since 2011. What are some of the other implications of that, the results? We've tripled the standard deduction. We're accused of not caring about people who earn less income. We're accused of only passing tax cuts for the rich and the millionaires. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our tax cuts have been well thought out. They benefit all North Carolinians.
So what happens next? Zoka has some ideas.
I call on all North Carolinians not to be fooled by clever rhetoric and by double speaking out of both sides of one's mouth. We have shown by what we've done, by what we've passed, and by the results that we've achieved that we're committed to improving the economic life for all North Carolinians, no matter how much they make, no matter what type of job they're in. We're here to help the whole state of North Carolina. And in our commitment to continuing tax reform that further helps our citizens, I call on Governor Cooper to join us, stop the doublespeak, and get on board.
That's Republican State Representative John Zoka, responding in a recent news conference to Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's complaints about the legislature's tax policies. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to carolinajournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's Raise the Age campaign is getting some high-profile support. The campaign aims to have most nonviolent 16- and 17-year-old criminal offenders treated as juveniles rather than adults. Among the supporters, Mark Martin, Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Now, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but North Carolina now stands alone. We are the only state in the country that automatically prosecutes 16-year-olds charged with minor nonviolent offenses in adult court. Now, this morning we read in an excellent article by John Hood that South Carolina passed a similar proposal, and it was unanimous. So it's time we catch up with our neighbors from south of the border. Now, what we're proposing is a very modest revision of our law. It is simply that when our teenagers are accused of nonviolent offenses, that they are not automatically tried in adult court. A recent Civitas poll that asked this question of parents across our state indicated that 70% of North Carolinians supported this proposal. Perhaps even more relevant, our own Department of Public Safety conducted surveys on this issue, which reflected that over 90% of parents already thought that 18 was the age for adult jurisdiction. Over 90% of our parents already thought this law had been changed.
Martin says the Raise the Age legislation would address a disparity in the existing state law.
We have up to 11 counties where the young people are already able to participate in administrative diversion programs. So in 11 counties, the young people are already automatically diverted to juvenile court and to restorative programs. So what does that say about young people in 89 other counties, given that one of the chief goals of any legal system is same facts, same outcome? But yet we have young people in up to 11 counties that have the benefit of administrative diversion programs for nonviolent offenses, but in the other 89, they do not. And I'll lead off with an illustration, because I get calls from parents who have financed a college education. We have a young person in Tennessee that steals a $12 pendant from the local mall. A North Carolina young person goes to the mall, takes the same item. Years later, they've both attended college. They're both trying to get that same job. The final step is the background investigation. In Tennessee and 48 other states, the whole matter is handled confidentially in juvenile court. In North Carolina, it's placed on the internet and so becomes a part of the background investigation. Normally, these charges are handled very quickly, so the child, the parents, they think it's behind them, only to learn 5 or 6 years later that it had a very serious effect on their ability to participate in the global marketplace.
Chief Justice Mark Martin isn't the only high-profile figure supporting the Raise the Age initiative. Former Republican Lieutenant Governor Jim Gardner is also adding his voice to the campaign.
I'm here today as a grandfather of 9 grandchildren, and I spent the last 4 years of my life at the ABC Commission dealing with underage drinking. And I know that young people, mine, yours, all across this state, will make bad choices, unfortunately. And I strongly support what the Chief Justice and everybody else in this room is doing, simply because they make a simple mistake should not be with them for the rest of their life. Now, I have a grandson right now who graduated last year from college. He has no record. He was an Eagle Scout. He still doesn't have a job. And I can just imagine what would happen if on his record was something he did at 16 or 17 years old. So, Judge, I think you're absolutely on the right track. It's long overdue, and I would say to all members of the legislature, let's get on with it, and let's get it done this year.
Former U.S. Magistrate Judge Bill Webb worked with the state Chief Justice to come up with the recommendations supporting the Raise the Age campaign.
The recommendations were, I think, so tightly reasoned that we were able to gain the support of the Sheriff's Association, the Police Benefits Benevolent Association, the Chiefs of Police Association, the John Locke Foundation, and the Conservatives for Criminal Justice Reform Committee. It has been a bipartisan, nonpartisan effort.
Webb turned to statistics.
Let's talk about what happens on the ground. Out of the felonies in 2014 committed by juveniles, there only 3% would not have qualified for this. This is a law and order measure. Studies have shown that when juveniles go through the juvenile justice system, the parents must be involved by court mandate. It's also shown that with all of the resources that the Department of Corrections, the chances of rehabilitation and the lack of recidivism are increased. We're able to once again, with these proposals, come back to sight and sound segregation. That means juveniles are separated from adult offenders. This will result in tens of millions of dollars flowing back to North Carolina, which we currently don't receive. The Department of Corrections stepped up to the plate to provide things like transportation, resources, that without this, we could not have garnered the support we did.
Wake County Sheriff Donnie Harrison supports the Raise the Age campaign. Harrison focuses on the impact the program could have on jails across North Carolina.
I'm blessed to have the jail that I have. When I say that, I wish I didn't have one, but I got 1,129 people in jail today. And I have pods for juveniles. There's a lot of jails throughout this state that does not, and they're housed with older people that put things in their head, make their light a little bit brighter if they go outside and commit crimes. But I think this initiative will stop some of that. I know it will. We need to get behind. There's a lot been said here. We need to get behind this initiative. Everybody needs to talk about it. It's something that needs to be done. It's well thought out. On the other hand, those listening, we need money. It's going to take money for more juvenile counselors, especially here in Wake County. They're bogged down, but it is going to take money. ADAs, so I just want to make sure everybody understands that. But this is something that we can pull off. This is some things that we can do with the support. You look around this room at the people that's here. And like I say, Justice Martin talks about people calling him. I have parents calling me all the time about small crimes. They don't understand it till the child does go try to go to a college or get a job. And they don't understand the record. So that's something that I look forward to, is that child that does that silly crime, that record will be expunged, taken off, won't ever be there if they go through the juvenile counselors, but it's going to take more.
More money, especially. That's Wake County Sheriff Donnie Harrison, one of the speakers at a recent news conference touting the potential benefits of the Raise the Age campaign. It aims to treat most nonviolent 16 and 17-year-old criminal offenders as juveniles rather than adults. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. For a lot of folks, nothing could be better on a warm summer day than enjoying a baseball game. That is certainly the case for my next guest, Julie Tisdale of the John Locke Foundation. Now, Julie analyzes city and county government issues for the Locke Foundation, and right now she's following the pursuit by several North Carolina cities to attract baseball teams. And of course, with that quest comes the need, they say, to build a ballpark. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
Ground zero right now in North Carolina is High Point in the Triad. Tell us what the proposal is there.
So High Point wants to build a ballpark downtown. The High Point government has actually already approved this. City Council has approved $15 million for land acquisition. It now goes to the Guilford County Commissioners. They're asking for $30 million to build a ballpark where a sort of minor league team, although not the official minor league teams affiliated with Major League Baseball, but a minor league team would play in High Point.
Now, a lot of people love baseball. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan. You're a fan. You go to games all over the country because you're a big San Francisco Giants fan.
I am. I was there 2 weekends ago.
So when you're writing about this, it's not because you don't like baseball or don't like sports. The issue for you is what?
The issue for me is taxpayer funding for stadiums. I love the idea of a baseball team in High Point. I love the idea of as many baseball teams as possible in as many cities as possible. That's like my dream world.
You're the dream customer for these teams.
Absolutely. And I go to a lot of games. I pay money to buy tickets to go to games, as do many other people. But my issue is with millions and millions of dollars of taxpayer money going to build a very expensive facility that is primarily going to benefit the owners of those teams, the people who are getting that ticket revenue that I and fans like me are paying. It seems to me that if they're the major beneficiaries, that they ought to be the ones building the facilities. We don't ask the government to build a building for Target to run their business. Why should we ask the government to build the building that the baseball team needs to run its?
And yet what we hear often from folks who support taxpayer subsidies for ballparks and other sports facilities, they say, look, it's about quality of life. Everybody is going to benefit in the end because we'll have a better quality of life in our area. How do you respond to that type of argument?
I certainly think that's true. And I think that lots of people agree that this contributes to our quality of life. So I think that where there really is sort of a gap there, often that can be met through philanthropy. People support the symphony. People support the opera. People support ballet. So if we want to provide things that need a little extra support, there are lots of philanthropists out there who want to support that kind of thing. But I think with baseball teams, actually, what we see is that they can be profitable businesses. Yes, they support our quality of life, and they improve that, as do restaurants and concerts and lots of things that are provided privately as business ventures without the need for any public money.
Now, in terms of High Point, this is not the first venture that they have been interested in. Tell us about the previous ballpark that you had followed in High Point.
So about a year ago, there was some discussion about building a new facility for the Thomasville High Point High Toms, which are sort of a summer league for college players, really. So very, very low-level baseball. They already play. They already have a facility, but it's old and it's small, and they wanted to build a new shiny one. That project died. It's not going to happen. And so they've moved on to this new, much grander, much more expensive project in downtown High Point.
Now, we'll see if the Guilford County Commission decides they're going to go in on this facility as well. So stay tuned on that story. Meantime, in Fayetteville, North Carolina, another city that thinks they want to get involved in this.
And Fayetteville is moving ahead. This is going to happen. So they are building a facility. They have spent a lot of taxpayer, or they're going to spend a lot of taxpayer money. They've committed that money to building this facility. The really interesting thing in Fayetteville, I think, that's just really remarkable, is that about a year or two before all of this sort of came to be, they had passed a property tax increase to pay for schools. That was how it was sold to voters. We're going to raise some revenue to build school buildings. The voters passed that. And a year later, the county government in Cumberland County said, wait, I think we'd rather spend that money on a ballpark. Let's repurpose it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So they literally took money away from schools to put into building this ballpark. And Cumberland County is not without significant school needs. I mean, they have millions and millions of dollars in needs for facilities, capital projects, the sorts of things that the county can pay for.
Did they get any pushback on that decision? It seems like one that would generate a lot of interest among the public.
I thought so. Actually, the school board had to sign off on it, and they did.
The school board agreed to it as well.
So, go figure. I have no idea what's going on down there in Cumberland County.
Do we have any sense of timing on that or any details about what type of facility or team or anything that because you say it is imminent, it's mm-hmm. going to happen?
It's going to be a minor league affiliate of the Houston Astros. That team, I think, actually is already playing this year in Buies Creek using Campbell's facility. Oh. But I believe that the plan is for the ballpark to be ready for next season.
The curious thing, Julie, is not only that these cities want to get involved, and in some cases they're using taxpayer funding and make interesting decisions like Fayetteville did in Cumberland County, but Major League Baseball, when it comes to teams that are affiliated with the big boys, you know, the mm-hmm. big show, Major League Baseball, is there a concern about saturation, particularly in a state like North Carolina, essentially too many teams, not enough customers?
There is. There is a minor league, an official minor league baseball system. These are the farm teams associated with the big league clubs. There is one of those in Winston-Salem, and there's another in Greensboro. There are several others in North Carolina, but those are the two in the triad. And minor league baseball has said repeatedly that High Point can't sustain a team, that three teams in that small geographic area would just be too much. the fact that we're going ahead, or that High Point is wants to go ahead with a team, really raises some questions for me. The professionals in this sphere don't think that there's sufficient demand. And so I think that maybe the government ought to be very, very cautious about committing millions of dollars of taxpayer money to a project that the big player really doesn't think is viable.
Julie, is it possible to build a baseball stadium, a ballpark of any kind, without taxpayer funding?
It absolutely is possible. It is very, very rare. People have come to just expect that they'll get government money. But the San Francisco Giants, my team, play at AT&T Park. It was built in 2000, and it was privately funded. The last one before that was Dodger Stadium.
My team.
In Los Angeles. Also, iconic ballparks like Fenway in Boston were built in an age before we had public financing for ballparks. So it certainly is possible, and very, very good long-lasting ballparks can be built that way.
So if these folks who are so interested, these city and county officials, if they went out and perhaps said, hey, we want private investment in this, they might find some folks in North Carolina or other states who are willing to invest in this.
In High Point in particular, I think they probably could pull that off. Nito Cobain, who is the president of High Point University, has sort of risen to this occasion and said that he and some of his friends, business associates, will commit $38 million to building facilities around the ballpark. If he quite quickly has been able to come up with $38 million for those sorts of facilities, then I think maybe they ought to try to go to Nito and some of his associates and see if we can find some private financing for the stadium itself.
It's a fascinating story about ballparks in North Carolina. It's been written by our guest, Julie Tisdale. You can read this piece at carolinajournal.com. Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.